Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
So listen, we know we've been away for a little bit. We miss you.
I know.
We miss you, but listen, it's been
about
like
a month.
Yeah, it's like a month since we dropped our last episode.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't had time to worry about you that much because we've been taking fabulous vacations.
On the beach.
This is what we do. We go parasailing, we swim with dolphins, and we just sleep in till whenever because, you know, vacation.
It's lies. Yeah, actually, guys, we have not been on vacation. Mm-mm. We've been in the field working on new episodes for the rest of the year.
Yeah, but we don't want to leave you guys hanging. I mean, we're not complaining about working.
No, we love working.
We love working.
We love working so much that we're back with you today for a little
bonus. Yeah, I mean,
bonus episode.
That was a slightly cheesy transition, but you know what? It's bonus episode time, so we're going to let that slide.
It's going to work.
Yeah.
And anyway, we'll be dropping a few of these bonus episodes between now and when we officially relaunch season 4.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, this particular bonus episode picks off where we ended season 3. In the Ville. It's a historically black neighborhood here in North St. Louis.
And if you guys heard our first show on the Ville, then you know it's pretty special.
Yeah, it used to be an enclave of prosperous black life here in St. Louis before desegregation and disinvestments began to unwind all of that.
Mm-hmm. And we teamed up with some friends of ours, producers from Out of the Blocks in Baltimore, it's a podcast, and volunteers from For the Ville here in St. Louis to tell stories of residents past and present.
So on today's bonus episode, we go back to the Ville for part 2.
With a few surprises at the end, so make sure you listen all the way through.
This is We Live Here from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX.
Show for people somewhere.
Bonus.
Somewhere not on vacation.
Somewhere not on vacation.
But somewhere on the woke spectrum.
We gotta get back to work.
60 years cutting hair. How many haircuts do you think you've given in your life?
Ooh, dare not even say. Let's put it like this. I've gone from the price of a haircut being $175 to now it's $15. Harry Thurston Jones. Harry's Barber Service, 4619 Dr. Martin Luther King Drive, St. Louis, Missouri, 63113. At one time, streetcars did ride up and down the street here. And all of these spots here were businesses. And gradually, people started moving westward. As people moved westward, the businesses were not replaced. The people that owned the property, it went derelict, and they took the pipe, they tore the buildings down. Eventually, they were all torn down. We're the last ones standing, the barbershop here and the liquor store, probably the last two buildings in here. Anything, that's it. This young man here, I knew his mother when they maintained a restaurant across the street called the House of Fine Foods. His mother was one of the waitresses at that before he was born. And I remember talking to his mother, and she told me, see, I had a boy, you know, COVID, and that's him. How old are you, man?
58.
In a conversation.
Harry, say your age now.
78.
How many more haircuts do you think you've got in you before you hang up the shears?
Well, whatever little money I stacked away, I'm apprehensive on stop getting money. And if I start spending it like I like to spend it, I think the money will run out before I run out. And as long as my health lasts, life is like on a racetrack. You start in here, that's when you're young. You run around this curve, you run around this curve, you run around this curve, you got the backside, and then you got a straightaway. There's no doubt about it, I'm on the straightaway. I'm on the straightaway now. I don't know how long it is to the end, but I'm definitely on the straightaway. You know, you wake up in one morning, your leg is hurting a little bit, or your arm. Sure, that goes with getting old, as you will find out.
Odell Wood, W-O-O-D. I'm 97 years old. Growing up in the Ville was a very, very close-knitted community, figuratively speaking. Everyone knew everyone. when World War II broke out, that's when it began to change, because at that time they let blacks move where they wanted to move. Before, they were just combined in one section, and it was very, very nice. When I was done with school, I got married and had two lovely daughters. I'll introduce you to Yvonne B. Tate, which is my baby daughter, and Marilyn Barnes, which is my oldest daughter.
Well, she's a power-packed woman, and she always taught us to just hold up your head and do the best that you can and be very good to others.
She used to say, pretty is what pretty does. So that meant that if it's not inside of you, you're not pretty at all. So that I've carried that with me all my life. And I just thank her for it, and I love her for that.
It must be amazing to live to see your kids retire.
It is. It's a rarity for parents to live to see their children retire. And I give all of that credit to Jehovah God.
And now you guys have all kinds of free time to spend together because you're all retired.
All retired. We all three are retired now, so we spend a lot of time together. I love them both, and I've been confiscated thousands and thousands of times with the help that they give me and the love that they give me. And I couldn't ask for anything any better being 97. They could have thrown me to the dog if they wanted to, but they didn't. They wanted me with them. And that's what I love about them. They're honest, they're loving, and they're kind, and they're true to the word.
John Herman Saunders Sr. now. Yeah, John Herman Saunders Sr., a.k.a. Jack. I was born in the basement of Barnes Jewish Hospital, Washington University Medical School Clinic for Negroes at that point in time. December 26, 1937.
What kind of a kid were you? What were you into?
Bad, everything. Yeah, man, I mean, I climbed in the coal bin and my mom's, oil off of coal got in my clothes. I guess she used Tide, spick and span it was, to get me clean in the bathtub. So that's the kind of kid I was. But anyway, the time that I grew up to, I heard the declaration of war over the radio with my parents. My dad served at Midway in the Navy, LST duty. The hurting thing after the war I saw was troops coming back in separate lines, blacks over here, whites over there. Bullshit, excuse the expression. You know, we would ride downtown and there would be separate counters downtown. But in the Ville, everybody was everybody. We didn't, and there was no real bias for people beyond being black.
The melody is Somewhere My Love, and it reminds me of my mom. That piano sits over there. That was my mom's piano. I think she started playing around 5 years old. And she played all the way through high school, college. And then she was a church pianist for Antioch for a while. I played the piano until she realized that I wasn't reading the music and I was wasting her time. You played it and I could play it back, but not now.
You don't play anything now?
No, I don't. Paula Sams. The last name is spelled S-A-M-S.
So, when we create our radio program, we put an original musical soundtrack together with the conversations that we have. My co-producer, Wendell, does that. He happens to be here hanging out with us today. Wendell, what kind of piano are we looking at here?
This is a beautiful Wurlitzer upright.
I wonder what you think about the idea of Wendell sitting down and giving this thing a try.
Have at it.
So you've been warned that it may be out of tune.
Yes, I have. So you haven't played this in a good while.
I'd clean it. There were two high schools that African Americans went to in St. Louis. Vachon High School, which my father went to, or Sumner High School, which my mom went to. And so when you meet people in St. Louis, the one thing that they always ask you is, what high school did you go to? I graduated from Sumner 44 years ago from Sumner, you know, and I can still remember the school song and the pledge.
What is the school pledge of Sumner?
I believe in the ideas of good citizenship, both for myself and my community. I resolve to obey the laws of this community, to respect its traditions.
I attended Marshall Elementary. I still remember the song from Marshall School. I'm going to sing it for you. Okay. It goes, Marshall, Marshall, we raise our voices in praise to you. Marshall, Marshall, to you will ever be true. My name is Warice Blackman Davis.
What kind of memories does it bring back to sing that song?
Oh, the memories of the hallways. We had a library in the hallways. We had a music teacher that expected you to enunciate every syllable of the songs that you sang. And we had teachers that cared. If you misbehaved, they tried to redirect your behavior. But you knew that by the time you got home, there were two or three people who already knew that you misbehaved and you were, you know, pretty much chastised for that. We had local stores, and I remember the store across the street from Marshall. If the bell rang, they would stop serving all children. You had to leave. You could not be served again until lunchtime. We could go home for lunch, actually. And going home for lunch sometimes, we would go across the street. And one of my girlfriends, she said, Warice, remember your mother would make us repeat the Lord's Prayer before we ate. You know, so she would feed whoever showed up. You know, if we had to cut sandwiches in half, that's what we did. But she made sure that we prayed before we ate and prayed before we left back out the door. That was just one of the things. And I think they, in hindsight, they kind of appreciated that.
I thought about coming over here this morning. I said, well, let me pull out my picture because I remember looking at it a few weeks ago. But I didn't really look. I've never delved into it until today. My full name is Ida Muhammad. This photo is a photo of myself and my three brothers and myself. My mother had four children. We were in my mother's barbershop, which was on St. Louis Avenue. She was one of the first black female barbers in St. Louis in the 50s and 60s. And I said when I was a young girl that I'd be so glad when I grow up because I'm sick of the barbershop and all these men and boys. And I'll be doing, as I grew up and matured in my development, 99% of my customers are barbers, so I'm in a barbershop every week of my life.
How do you end up in barbershops?
Well, basically, I sell various different products. I have pies, of course, the bean pies, and I have the publication of the Final Call newspaper, and I have CDs and DVDs, and that's basically it. I used to be in the barbershop, and of course, there was a lot of activity and people coming in and out. I remember there were some young men coming in at that time. They were suited very nice, and they had a look about themselves. They were very groomed. I never forgot the look of how those guys looked, and they were brothers in the Nation of Islam. And I said, you know, as a little girl, I didn't really know, but I knew they were clean, and they had all the guys had on suits. So that was that, and they carried a paper called the Final Call newspaper. So basically, I decided as I became older that I would go into the Nation of Islam after hearing Minister Farrakhan do one of his lectures in 84 at UMSL. It's one of the universities out west. It just, you know, really opened up my eyes. I've been in the Nation now since 85, and it's the best thing to open up your eyes, because we as a people have been so confused and lost with the knowledge of self.
I'll say it like this. It wasn't so much the information that we were getting, because they were aware of that. It was how good we were at what we did. That was the part that we didn't want them to know. Sidney Henry Frazier, and this is St. Louis Avenue in Vandeventer. Went to college for 1 year. I ran out of money. I went into service. I took all of these tests, and the service approached me about being in a really good career field, which they couldn't explain to me what it was. But they said, this is really good. So I figured, what do I have to lose? It was an analyst in military intelligence. I spent a year in Vietnam. We flew in C-47s. They used to call them Goonie birds, full of electronic equipment. And what our job was to locate the North Vietnamese Army, not the guys in the black pajamas, but the ones in uniforms, the actual formal North Vietnamese Army, and report this back. You had to fly to your target area. There were several areas all around where you would fly for 8 hours and pick up as much information as you could. But I had 47 combat missions over South Vietnam. They didn't count the missions that were aborted, meaning if the plane caught fire, which happened, you lose an engine. But that was not uncommon. These planes, these are World War II planes. And I'm in Vietnam in 1971. Well, I'll tell you one instance where we're flying along and the oil pressure in the starboard engine got low. And you had to shut the engine down because it's going to catch fire if you don't. So it'll fly with one engine. Okay, so they shut the engine down. And when they shut the engine down, they have to do what they call feathering. You have to lock the propeller on the dead engine. Well, the feathering switch was attached to both propellers. So when they hit the feathering switch, both engines went out. You know, because it locked the propeller on the one that was running. And what impressed me was that the pilots, we're getting ready to bail out. We're putting on our parachutes and stuff, you know. The pilot and the co-pilot sat down and went through the checklist and did everything and started that engine back up. They didn't know why it went out, for starters. But if they went through the checklist, they just inadvertently found out and started the engine. There was nothing wrong with the other engine. And so we didn't have to crash that day. But that was a pretty close call.
You're in the Ville in North St. Louis.
One neighborhood,
everybody's story.
It's Out of the Blocks.
Out of the Ville.
So, yeah, this area is mainly our lettuce and tomato and eggplant area.
4057 Evans Avenue, St. Louis, Missouri, 63113, on the corner of MLK and Sarah.
As you can see on this far right, closest to the fence, is where a lot of our basil was grown in those three beds.
James Forbes.
Matt Soinoff.
It is what you see. It's a sustainable, organic farm here in the city. Formerly, it was a gas station, and then it was an abandoned lot for about 20 years. One day I met Alderman Sam Moore here. He pointed to this property and said, if you want this property, I'll get it to you for $5. And so I said, done.
This is, as James had mentioned, our aquaponics system.
It looks like there's a bunch of raised beds, almost like they look like giant pool tables, but they're full of gravel and plants.
That is essentially what we have in here. We have four grow beds, and what we have is four 500 IBC tank, 500 gallons that is, and they house over 300 fish among the four of them. I guess the simplest form to put it is the fish make waste. There's a pump in the water. It pumps it up through the PVC onto that filtering pad, and the remaining waste becomes super nutrients for the plants. So it's a closed-loop cycle, very sustainable.
It was one of those things where you kind of wonder, you know, like, is this going to work? And, like, is it something where people are going to just hop the fence, like burn everything down, you know, like start vandalizing and stealing? And that hasn't been the case. I mean, it really would start with people just like asking, you know, like, what are you guys doing here? What is all this stuff? And we would tell them about the purpose of it, and then also for it to be a food access point, because we're sitting in a federally classified food desert.
So whenever certain crops hit their or are nearing their end, that's the prime time for community members to know that they can come here and buy our produce for a dollar, or there's days where they just come here and clip it directly themselves and take it home, wash it, and have food for the next few days.
The one thing that this part of St. Louis that it does have going for it is an abundance of cheap, affordable property. I mean, like I said, this property was given to us for $5, and the city's adamantly saying that they're just trying to give this stuff away to anyone that could do anything with it. We're obviously biased, but I mean, there is the potential to turn it into a food production area where that demand does exist. And the plants don't care about crime statistics or like violent around. They just need, you know, like water, light, and nutrients and someone to tend to them.
What a remarkable view it is looking in this direction from your garden. You've got your garden beds. Then you've got, yeah, you can all see all the way down to the St. Louis Arch.
Yep, it's one of my favorite views of the entire farm.
We're on the corner of Maffitt and Bishop Scott in St. Louis, Missouri. It's the Ville area. There are a number of churches around us, and we always identify ourselves as the little church on the corner doing great things for the Lord. I'm Ivan C. James III, and I am the pastor here at Asbury United Methodist Church. I've been here for about 7 years. This is the sanctuary. We probably can seat anywhere from a couple of 100 to 300 people in here. It was a very large congregation, but over the years it has dwindled a bit. And what we're about now is trying to figure out how we can do a better job of serving the community and also to grow our church, you know. I have a social gospel. The other day I talked about God has blessed us so that we can be a blessing to someone else. And each time we help somebody who is in need, then we're being a blessing. And we're fulfilling what God is asking us to do. We have one program which is called Warm Start, where we feed kids juice and granola bar every morning. So before the kids go to school, they come by and get a granola bar and a juice. That little snack we give is probably the only meal those kids have in the morning before they get to school. And it might be, in some cases, the last meal that might be they didn't get anything the evening before. So we served, like today, I stopped and looked at the figures, and we served about 55 kids this morning. When you can help the least and the lost and those in hunger, then you're doing what you need to do.
Sheila Steed.
Julia Allen.
We're cousins.
We live in the historic field.
I'm 68, and she'll be 68.
How long have you guys lived together in the same home?
I think since 2006. It's been a while. I used to live in our family home, and then I made a decision that I needed to move away from my family. And so I called my cousin and asked her if I could stay with her. And it's actually a way of us to share bills and everything. And because, you know, in this economy, it's kind of hard to live off of one salary with, you know, especially when you get older and you're on a fixed income.
How is Julia as a roommate?
The best partner ever. We finish each other's sentences. We know each other's likes and dislikes.
When we get mad at each other, she goes to her room and I go to mine.
With any two people living together, you have to decide what you can handle and what you can't.
Sheila has a place for everything, and I'm not very good at that.
You had a choice of going to a different place. So why did you decide to come to the house and share a house with me?
Well, I told her this one time, because I'm blessed, okay, that we are cousins, that we've grown up together. We may not have always agreed on things, but I love her. If it wasn't for her, and she may not really understand this, I wouldn't be where I am.
Uh-oh. It's wonderful to be able to say that family, no matter what their differences, they're family, and you got to remember that. It's just that simple.
I was truly a soccer mom when it came to my kids' education. My wife worked during the day. I worked at night at different jobs, and I kept them during the day. William Brooks. I had been in the neighborhood for like 28 years, and I use a measuring stick of the ages of my two sons, which are twins. Both of my two sons are very well-rounded men. I have one who is he's a first lieutenant in the Army and also a St. Louis County police officer. And my other son, who is Alex, he is a mechanical engineer.
It pays to pay attention. That is one of my father's mottos. So I'm stealing all his stuff, but it pays to pay attention. My name is Alex Brooks. I'm William Brooks' son.
One of them, one of the two twin boys.
Yes, one of the sons. I am the second son.
By how many minutes?
1 minute, but he kind of holds it that it's a mystery how many minutes it was, so we don't really know is the official line.
My philosophy on family and raising kids, it requires a lot of attention. You know, you really have to pay attention to your kids and be devoted to them and know that you are the first teachers.
He raised us in a very deliberate way, that a lot of the stuff that he did was a piece of some sort of master plan. One of those would be my brother and I, we didn't ride the bus.
My wife and I, we took our kids to school every day of their lives. What that afforded us is the time to communicate to our kids about real life situations, simply because as we drove through the city, you would see different situations of people on the street, and I would speak to, why do you think that person is doing what he's doing? Okay, it could be someone staggering on the street, or it could be someone collecting cans, you know, and that would become a part of the socialization of our kids as to what was going on in life.
I realize now that a lot of the things that he said, as much as it seemed like I was just waiting that 15 minutes until we were able to get out and go onto the schoolyard, a lot of that stuff stuck. And even now, I think that he's been doing a good job of trying to lead us from afar. Me and my brother, we've moved away. We're living separately, and he's doing his best to guide us, not let us get too far off the good path here, but also allow us to make mistakes so long as they're not too big and do our own thing.
I'm jealous of them, okay. In as much that they have accomplished things that I wish I could have at their age. They have turned out to be the sons that I always wanted.
Janet Roberson. I live in the Ville neighborhood, and I've been living here now for 8 years this past August. And what caused me to come this location was I heard that they were having houses built for families that of low income, and I was able to qualify for it. It gives you a sense of having something of your own. Even with my children, we have our own backyard, the own front porch that we're sitting on, and I could grow my flowers, I could cut my own grass, and that's, to me, some people may take that for granted, that that's just something you do all the time. But if you've never had a home before, it's just different having your own home that you can call yours. I chose this house, and when I came to the door, it was two men inside. They were still fixing on the house, doing construction. And I came in, and the fellow looked up, and he said, "Twin." And I said, "James." We had went to kindergarten together and grew up together. He had actually built my house. And he said, "Is this your house?" And I said, "Sure, it's my house." But I hadn't signed anything or had papers on it. I claimed this house to be my house. And he said, "Go on and look at it." And I went upstairs. And I actually had some, I'm a very spiritual person, and I love the Lord. And I had some oil, and I put it in each room of my house. And I said, "Thank you for my house, Lord. Thank you for my girl's room." And I'm sorry. And I just believed that this was going to be my house. And I left, and then maybe about a week later, they called me and told me I had the house. And the excitement and the joy that me and my children had when we came in the house, we jumped up. We just went all through the house and just said, "This is our house." And it was an exciting moment, a moment I would never forget. And I love it. I think I'll be here until I go to heaven.
Okay, so it was so cool hanging out with Miss Jan and really getting to know so many people over there in the Ville.
Yeah, it was probably, I would say, of all the shows that we did or produced last season, I don't know. This is
my favorite. It's way high up there. But you know what?
More.
It's not over.
Bonus.
Word of the day? Bonus. Okay, guys. So officially what you heard was the result of our three-way collabo. I'm going to send it over.
No, you're not. We're going to keep rolling because that laugh is addictive.
Our collaboration. our tri-collaboration.
All I did was raise an eyebrow. And I got that. One eyebrow.
Oh, God. So officially, that was the end of the collaboration. But like, this is our show. We do what we want. So we actually have extra stories to share with you guys, if you can bear with us a little bit. The first one is from Marlon Boyd, who also has a pretty distinct nickname.
Well, a lot of people call me M. That's like Emergency Miracle Man. I sell a lot of stuff. So Emergency Miracle Man, E-M-M-M. Because I like to sell a lot of stuff, first of all. Then when, especially while I'm a hairstylist, by being a hairstylist, I make the ladies look beautiful, so I'm a miracle worker. So a friend gave me that name, M, Emergency Miracle Man. Hairstyling is really in the family blood. I have a lot of cousins, brothers and sisters that actually do hair, but I'm the one that kept going professionally. Name is Omni Barber and Beauty Supply, Beauty Salon and Supply, 2908 North Newstead. Well, the history of this place, I guess this salon been here for 32 years. I've been in salon here for 27. But I guess my father used to be a barber here. They used to work down the street. It used to be another salon called Omni Barber Beauty Salon on Lexington and Newstead, and they moved to St. Louis Avenue and Newstead again about 32 years ago, and I came here from beauty school. I was 19 years old, coming out of beauty school, and didn't want to go find a salon, but I knew my father and my god uncle had a salon here close by from the beauty school I was going to on Union, United Artists Beauty College. So I just came here because it was not as scary to adapt to other co-workers, because I was here with family, so I came here to this salon. Okay, the styles that I do, I basically, I do women hair, so I cut. I love cutting, so I'm a cut expert. So I'm a cutter. I do a lot of spiky, funky hairstyles with short hair, and then I also add weave. I do bonding, you know, glued, sew-ins, I braid. But now I'm not a braider, but I do braid for styles. And I keep the women looking fresh, you know, do the little fades on them and stuff. And I learned the fades from my father. My father used to be a barber, of course. And he taught me how to barber cut while I was going to beauty school, because there was a school, they used to come up to the school, which was Annie Malone Children's Home. We was one of the schools that cater to helping the kids that were unfortunate to really go to the barbershops. So our school helped keep the kids together.
Hold on one second.
How you doing, Miss Carol? Yeah, he's here. Yeah, he's here too. Everyone that comes in the salon basically know each other from the neighborhood, or they meet someone that they already knew in the past, and they kind of know each other. But it's a small salon, but it's a family salon. So
he gonna curl my hair up and make me look sexy. Probably about it. Neoshia Moore. I've been coming here for like 25 years. And Marlon is a good stylist. He do his very best. And every time I go somewhere, I get very good compliments and stuff like that. And I just enjoy coming. Oh, he's very kind-hearted. Sometimes he get on my nerve being so kind. You know, sometimes people do take his kindness for weakness. You know, because he be so sweet to them and stuff. And they don't want to pay him his money. But I get mad about that. Because I think everybody work hard. They need their money. Yeah. Just like the doctor, you know. Do a good job, you got to come back.
When I first started, it was more waves, more stacks and ponytails. Then it transitioned over to just wanting the short hair because they seen a celebrity on TV, Anita Baker. So everyone wanted the short styles. Then it was doing the finger waves a little bit. Then they kind of flew out, and then another style came in, and it was short in the top, long in the back, like a mullet. Then after that, mullet came. Now the long hair is here, you know. So everyone wants to wear the weave, the long weave. They want it to be believable, so they want the weave. But now that the waves are coming back in, too, so now they want the waves and the color. They go big now with crazy colors, green, blue, purple, pink. So now the colors is a big thing. First it was the punk rockers doing it, you know, and you had to be a punk rocker. But now it has become one of those colors that I need a color in my hair now. And they go with these odd colors, turquoise and green, and, you know, weird colors now. Some things I won't do because I don't want my character to be that crazy looking. I will do it modestly and add a few colors here and there, but then some colors I won't do because I just don't think it works for work. You know, some people that wear these weird colors don't work, I guess. And some jobs don't allow all that, so I won't do it.
All right, so we are at our final story of our bonus episode for you of our collaboration with our really good friends at Out of the Blocks, which if you don't subscribe to that podcast, go
what
subscribe.
What are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing with yourself?
We told you about it before.
Reevaluate
just
your life.
Go subscribe.
Yeah, go subscribe. Really, truly, just a great show. Lots of great stories from all over Baltimore and from St. Louis. So anyways, we've got one more story left to share, and we're going to close the show by sharing you a little bit more of a story you kind of started to hear earlier in this episode. It comes from Jack Saunders.
You may remember him as the kid who jumped in his mom's Colbin, or his vivid memories of troops coming home from World War II and marching in segregated lines.
So he's really interesting because he spent his career in housing and urban development, and his whole life is shaped by the Ville, preserving its history and now laying the groundwork for its future.
So one more time, here's Jack Saunders.
Okay, the racial cohesion that I saw, I guess, from kindergarten forward was a compilation of people going in the same direction with a purpose. The business community, I got pictures of the businessmen going back to the 20s, where they banded together and invested in each other. And that was the continuity that they wanted to maintain control. The crime rate was damn near zilch because everybody was doing something constructive there, you know. And I realized in 71 that historic preservation was something that needed documentation relative to us. We pulled together a group of core group, and I guess it was about 12, 14 that would meet once a month about how to preserve the veil. And so from 71 forward, you know, we worked on trying to put an application together that was consistent with the criteria called for. So I've always recognized staying within the parameters or the mandates that the system would yield the resources to preserve some of the buildings, because without the buildings, you know, you can't keep the thought of what they were trying to do. Sumner High School, Stowe Teachers College, etc. My wife and I do pray every morning about our work. But, so the hurdle, the quest in this life journey is not really a challenge to me, because I understand that we both understand the business model of putting together hope for tomorrow exists with what the shit you do today. You know, there is a way to make the North Side come alive again, and it's got to be cross-cultural or inclusive as we go. Moral is never quit. And I don't plan to, from the cradle to the grave. And I lost my daughter, she was 22 in 81, and met my wife in 82. But at any rate, you can't let life defeat you. You got to keep on going forward and have some purpose in mind that's bigger than you. At least that's my approach to living. I ain't got too many regrets. I got a few, but don't want to talk about them.
So we want to make sure one more time to give a very heartfelt and special thank you to our good friends, Aaron Hinken and Wendell Patrick. They produce the excellent Out of the Blocks podcast from WYPR. That's the public radio station in Charm City in Baltimore. They are awesome people, and that show is really, really cool. Go subscribe now.
And also, we got a lot of people here to thank, like For the Ville, and specifically Aaron Williams and
Everybody who talked to us.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us and for trusting us to share them with all of our friends, all of you guys.
And we really mean it when we say this was producing the show or helping produce the show, because it was really like a bunch of people helped produce the show. It was one of the coolest things we did all of last year, I think.
It was a highlight.
Yeah,
huge
for sure.
Huge highlight.
All right, so I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley.
And together we produce this show.
We live here.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX.
Thanks. See you soon.
Bye.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.